Let's go to Brother Andre Marie here in the from the St. Benedict Center and do our Wisdom of Wednesday here for today. And Brother is taking a little time out from his duties at the school as headmaster. And don't forget, the St. Benedict Center Conference is coming up October 7th and 8th at the St. Benedict Center in Richmond, New Hampshire. Yours truly will be there. Many people that you see, know, and sometimes love in the chat room will also be there, sometimes. And many great speakers, including Commander John Sharp and Brother and Sister Maria Philomena, and, of course, the one and only Joe Doyle. Brother Andre, good morning.
Good morning, Mike. How are you today?
I am well. Thank you very much. I am
good.
Returned from the country, from paradise, and now back here in a moderate-sized, mid-level urban America. But it is good to be back in the old studio environ. What's the fall weather like? What do we have to look forward to in a month?
I can't speak about what you're gonna have in a month, but it's actually sort of coolish today. We've got some pre-fall going on right now, and some of the trees are beginning to show some colors. This is the first dreaded sign that we're going to get cold soon. but actually it's been beautiful weather. Last couple of days we had a lot of rain, which we kind of needed. But it would have been nice if we had that in July when we had a bit of a drought. So, but no complaining. God sent it, so we're grateful.
Brother, I wanted to talk a little bit today about Brother Francis's series from Philosophy of Perennis on ethics. And I very much enjoyed reacquainting myself with the three A's. The three A's that he mentions, and I think that our listeners would also gain some useful wisdom from it, and it might even encourage some of them that have been putting it off to take the course, the Philosophia Perennis course.
Okay.
So, where shall we start with the three A's? First of all, what are the three A's? I believe it's ethics lecture number 6.
Okay, you've just sandbagged me, Mike.
Did I?
Sorry, I'm flat-footed. I don't know what you have to familiarize with me with it. I had a very tense morning with
Appreciation
computer failures in our school.
Yeah. Okay, I'm sorry. Appreciation, adventure, and accomplishment.
Okay.
So brother says that that the world would be a better place if everyone knew the three A's, the three powers, as he described it in ethics number 6, appreciation, adventure, and then accomplishment, which is if you had an appreciation for the world as God created it for you, I guess, you'd be better off. And you set a goal or something for yourself, something you're going to do, you know, the final cause. Then you go on an adventure, make it an adventure. And then when you realize it, then it's an accomplishment. But most people don't put it in that order.
No. I had to close a window because the wind is blowing in the window on my mic, so you might be hearing these sort of subsonic sounds. You wouldn't hear it as subsonic. You're gonna hear these bass woofer sounds. I just stopped it. But it all begins with appreciation. I mean, Brother Francis was a big one for appreciation, and not just, I should say, because I knew him intimately, I knew him very personally, he was a big one for appreciation, not simply at a theoretical level. It was extremely practical for Brother, and he had a close appreciation of individuals, you know. He was famous for saying, he would often cite this ridiculous example, and to even to hear the words Marilyn Monroe on Brother Francis' lips was kind of incongruous. But he once saw a clip of her. I think he was maybe out bookselling or something, and he saw a clip of Marilyn Monroe saying to the soldiers, you know, when she would go do these things to the soldiers overseas during the war, she said, "I love you, each and every one of you." And Brother Francis noted that this is absolutely absurd. You can only love somebody you know. And the love of neighbor, for instance, when our Lord illustrates love of neighbor, he illustrates it very concretely with that beautiful parable of the Good Samaritan. And, you know, your neighbor is him who is nigh to you, near you. So you have to have some knowledge of this person, even if you just happened upon him on the road or whatever, and he's abandoned, whatever. It's still a person that you can begin to know in the concrete rather than just some abstraction. You know, a lot of people have done a lot of awful things to humans in the name of love for humanity. Think of the population control agenda and similar and related evil agendas, which have done a lot to harm people and even to kill them, huh? Or prevent their birth. So, I illustrate this point to say that Brother Francis was big into not reducing other humans to mere abstractions, you know, that we love sort of as an idea, sort of some bleached platonic idea in our mind. No, we have to love concrete people, whether they strike us as lovable or not. That's the challenge of the gospel. But he translated this into his appreciation of individuals. When you were talking to Brother Francis, you were the only person in his orbit at that time. You were his sole interest at that time. That's certainly the impression that people got, and people even me. I mean, people had a sense of, wow, he really values me. And the liberals like to talk about human dignity, but Brother Francis, who was very anti-liberal, showed people how you treat other people with dignity, and it really did make people rise to the occasion. For him, appreciation was a big deal. You know, even in his prayer life, you know, he wanted to make sure that he appreciated all the graces that God gave him, and he wasn't just sitting down to pray so that he could check off a laundry list of petitions and, you know, just and complain to God about what he didn't get. You know, he didn't have. He would sometimes in his prayers, and he told us this, sometimes in his prayers he would think through his life and all of the blessings that he had gotten in it and thank God for it. So without that spirit of appreciation, your whole perspective on life is going to be somewhat warped, because all you're going to look at is what you don't have rather than what you do have, or to look at what you hate rather than what you love, to look at what's, you know, negative rather than positive, however you want to put it. It's a question of perspective. And if we appreciate what it is God has given us, even the crosses, right? I should maybe say especially the crosses, because, you know, there we have the tremendous sort of regal honor to participate in our Lord's royal way of the cross, to borrow a little bit from Father Feeney's Bread of Life. He talks about the royal way of the cross. So, it all begins with appreciation, because without appreciation, you're not going to rise to those other two A's and look at life as an adventure, you know.
Yeah. So. Well, as I was listening, because I listened to Ethics 4, 5, and 6 on my drive over to the country on Friday. There's something else that brother said that and I needed a good refresh. And all of you that have taken Philosophia Perennis, I encourage you to refresh the course from time to time and listen to some of the episodes. You know, and I was thinking about this, and I'm thinking of regime leader Biden with that pinko red commie background, demonic background on Thursday night, clenching his fists, snarling through his teeth, scowling at people and yelling and accusing 80 million people of being insurrectionists and extremists and what have you here. Something that brother said, though, struck me, and you have to remember this, not to excuse any of this, don't misunderstand, but that all human activities, every man and everything that every man does is to achieve happiness. You pursue happiness. Even if it's warped and it's evil, they still, you know, in the criminal mind, I guess, the corrupt mind, still directed towards happiness. And this is a part of philosophy that, you know, may make you be tend to be more to take the part of the potter knows there of the Lord's prayer about forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. If you thought that they were pursuing happiness, even though they got it wrong.
Yeah. Sorry, Mike.
I hear the lawn service. Yes.
Yeah. Good old rural living here, Mike. I just closed my second window, so now my office will be sweltering any minute. So if you hear me snoring, it's because all my oxygen got used up.
Okay, happiness. The pursuit of happiness.
So, I mean, the pursuit of happiness is something which is utterly impossible unless you know what the goal of happiness is, right?
Right.
I mean,
right.
We talk about, you know, every man is free to pursue happiness, but what is it? I mean, it's not Shirley MacLaine's, you know, follow your bliss. It's obviously something, what is happiness constituted? Even the pagan philosophers understood that happiness was something in a way transcendent. It wasn't merely material, huh? And it wasn't something that it wasn't some sort of physical ecstasy. It wasn't mere bodily pleasure, which is what most people, very sadly, seem to think constitutes happiness. And this is why these things are always unsatisfactory. You know, we were made to participate in the very life of God. And what we, instead of pursuing the happiness in the infinite being, we quasi in infinitize created things, and that of course is what leads to gluttony. That of course is what leads to alcoholism, and any sort of intemperance, because people want they want to find happiness in these things. And by happiness, they really mean pleasure. So it's kind of the Epicurean / hedonistic notion of happiness, really the hedonistic notion of happiness, which is impossible to achieve because these things were meant to be taken in moderation, and the immoderate use of them, of course, is destructive to our natures. Whether that thing is, you know, the pleasures of the marriage bed, or whether that thing is the food or drink or any other material enjoyment, if you infinitize this thing improperly and say, I'm going to get infinite happiness out of this finite thing, you're going to abuse it, and ultimately you're going to abuse yourself in the process. So these things which were meant to be things that bring us to our help us on the path to our true happiness have to be used in certain moderation. The things what does our true happiness consist? Even Aristotle understood, and Plato understood it involved in something of the mind, something of the soul, so that man's true happiness is found in the perfection of his very highest faculties, his intellect, his will, and to know the truth and to love the good. So for Aristotle, happiness is found in contemplation.
Right.
And this is, and this might sound boring to people, but it's not boring. It's actually very thrilling. You know, contemplation comes in different forms. But when you know, my brother and I were talking one day about contemplation, and my oldest brother, he's kind of the Adonis of the family. He's a bodybuilder. I mean, he's in his early 60s now, but he still works out. But one of the things he most loves, as far as diversions, on the, he was a very hard worker. He was in the federal service for years. But one of the things that he most enjoyed as a diversion was snow skiing and snowboarding and things like that, which of course you don't do when you're in Louisiana. So he had to come up north. So every once in a while he visits us in New Hampshire. So and he'll do some snowboarding on the side while he's here. But the idea is that for him, it was something he'll do all by himself. And he's telling me how he can pray while he's doing it, and because he's contemplating nature.
Ah.
And that is an actual experience of contemplation. It's of course, it's not exactly what St. Teresa of Avila and John of the Cross would have been writing about. But contemplation is to be seized by the object contemplated. It's not an active thinking about something as much as it is a sort of an ecstatic vision of the thing. The thing seizes you, right? And anybody who's looked at a beautiful mountain, a gorgeous tree, a beautiful river, you know, has been seized by it in that way, knows exactly what I'm talking about. This is what gives us poetry. This is what gives us great works of art, including music, including paintings, including sculpture and so forth. That ecstatic vision of something is the contemplative experience. Now, religiously, that same thing is translated into the experience of God, or technically we should say the quasi-experience of God, because God isn't directly experienced until the beatific vision in heaven. So that constitutes our true happiness. So when St. Thomas talks about happiness, he simply baptizes Aristotle in a way. I mean, he's taking the gospel. He's not staying in that Greek philosophical milieu, but he's saying, look, you know, God gave us an intellect, this is our highest faculty, and to know truth and to contemplate truth in its essence is the highest thing that we can do, and the love of the good that is that truth overflows into our wills, and it even overflows into our bodily faculties, and has us completely captured in this truth and this goodness. St. Thomas takes that and applies it to our experience of the Trinity, huh?
Right.
And to our experience of God, and that man's highest good is contemplation. His happiness is found in contemplation, and the highest contemplation is contemplation of God Himself as He is in His essence.
And brother says, if I remember correctly, I just listened to this the other day, that people might confuse this between contemplation and meditation. Meditation is when you're acting upon the object, and contemplation is when the object is acting upon you.
Yes,
that's
exactly it.
Okay. So
I just said that in a lot more words.
Yes, you did. But I just give people something simple to refer to. If you're going like, okay, brother, that was, no. And this is why, you know, we're refreshing your Philosophia Perennis knowledge is good. Because I could get that one out without blowing it, brother.
There you go.
So you're in the middle of a Wisdom Wednesday segment. Now, we can segue and talk a little bit about adventure, but I think that this treats up very nicely with your ad rem, since you mentioned St. Thomas, of what St. Thomas wrote about grace. So in your latest ad rem, which was, as you say, your goal was not to go through the graces. Your goal was to just kind of explore with the reader what St. Thomas was writing about when he was writing about the graces.
Yeah. Yeah. So we talked about the division of grace. That's the division
of grace, right?
Yeah. Because you know, we a lot of us know from the Catechism. Okay, so grace comes in two forms, so to speak, actual grace and sanctifying grace. Well, St. Thomas said an awful lot more about that, and really he said way more than what I intimated, because I'm just focusing on one section of the Summa, where he's talking about the division of grace into these certain categories. So would you like me to just sort of give the 30,000 view of that question, Mike?
Yes, give the flying above the ski slope that you don't ski on view.
Yeah, because as I said in the chat room, I don't want to end up in traction.
I'm with you.
God made me to be, let's put it this way. When my father used to say of me that I'm graceful as the bird they call the elephant, he wasn't, blowing smoke. I am a klutz, to use the Yiddish.
Yes. If you're considering snow skiing, just two words to remember, or three words, remember Sonny Bono.
Okay. Yes. Exactly. Oh my goodness. I shouldn't laugh at that. The poor man.
Remember Sonny Bono and you won't.
Yeah. No, I would make Sonny Bono. I would go out in a real bang. I mean, of course, I'd be on the kiddie slopes anyway. But to give the 30,000 view of the question of grace, St. Thomas had multiple divisions in which he categorized grace, both actual and sanctifying. And some of this is a bit tricky. I'll just try to summarize it quickly. But the first division that he gives in question 111 of the Prima Secundae is this. Grace freely given and grace which makes pleasing. Now, he of course wrote this in Latin, so we're talking about gratia gratis data and gratia gratum faciens. Now, grace freely given is, he makes the point that all grace is really freely given, but he's taking that phrase from St. Paul, who's talking about these different graces that are given in the church. And St. Paul names several of these and talks about the one Spirit giving us the word of wisdom, to another he gives the word of knowledge, to another he gives the working of miracles, to another prophecy, the discerning of spirits, and diverse kinds of tongues, and to others the interpretation of speeches. This kind of, this is what we call charismatic graces. And St. Thomas lists these as the grace is freely given, and he says these are less noble than grace which makes pleasing, because grace is freely given are really for the sanctification of other people. They have nothing to do with the sanctification of the recipient of these graces. So if I can speak in tongues, or if I can prophesy, or if I can work miracles, that's not a sign of my sanctity. That is something that's given to me to help others. And by the way, I don't do any of those things. But Padre Pio's sanctity did not consist in his various gifts of reading souls and things like that. There are more charismatic graces than St. Paul enumerates. But Padre Pio could read souls. He had all kinds of special gifts. He worked all kinds of miracles. But that wasn't his sanctity. His sanctity was the grace which makes pleasing, which was one of St. Thomas's names for what we call sanctifying grace. He called it habitual grace, gratia habitualis, and he also called it grace which makes pleasing, gratia gratis faciens, gratia gratum faciens, grace which makes graceful, pleasing, okay? So the word grace has like 14 distinct meanings in Latin, and in English, by the way. So St. Thomas talks about sanctifying grace as grace which makes pleasing. Why? Because when the soul is beautified with sanctifying grace, it's made pleasing to God, truly pleasing to God. Poor Martin Luther didn't believe this. So for Martin Luther, it was just what he called, the word is escaping me. His idea of justification, forensic justification, it was purely external. And, you know, God sort of imputed the merits of Christ to you, but essentially God was lying to himself because he said, yeah, this guy's holy, when he really isn't, right? So the Council of Trent defined that grace was an interior renewal so that we become a new man and we become truly pleasing to God. We're pleasing in God's sight. So that's what St. Thomas means when he says grace which makes pleasing. And it's set in distinction from grace freely given, because the graces freely given are really for the sanctification of others. Sanctifying grace sanctifies the recipient of that grace. And that's why it's called grace which makes pleasing. So,
but you know what, brother? I'm reading your ad rim now. I just got to it this morning. And you talk about, and St. Thomas, you talk about, it's called habitual grace because it is a habit. You know, in one of those ethics lectures that I listened to, 4, 5, or 6, brother talked about the habits. And he says, good habits become virtues.
Well, good habits are virtues, exactly.
Yeah, right.
A habit, of course, is a stable quality of soul. It's more or less permanent. Yeah, it can be done away with if you commit vice. A good habit. But, you know, vices are habits, too. So those are bad habits. Virtues are good habits. And you can have supernaturally infused virtues like faith, hope, and charity, as well as the moral virtues when God puts them in our soul. And then we have acquired virtues, which are the virtues that we acquire by our own effort, by doing repeated acts. And those repeated acts form habits, and those good habits are virtues. So, yeah. So the next division, by the way, is I asked the question, what about sanctifying grace and actual grace? So St. Thomas doesn't use these two words, but he uses the realities. Because, as I said, he calls what we call sanctifying grace, he calls habitual grace, and he also calls it grace which makes pleasing. He also calls it justification, because it's the same thing as justification. Actual grace, St. Thomas didn't use that term, but he does talk about the helps that we get from God, divine helps, which move the will to act. Okay, that's a perfect description of actual grace. It's called actual grace, not because it's set in contradistinction to unreal grace. It's called actual grace because it's meant to terminate in an act, a salutary act, an act that leads us to goodness. Either it leads us to the faith, or it leads us to do some meritorious good work once we're in the state of grace. But actual grace is, these are the movements that come from God to move our souls towards Him. And they happen all the time. I mean, the world is flooded with actual graces, and many of them are simply, most sadly, are simply unheeded. We have that statue, that image of Our Lady of Grace, where you see the sort of the rays coming from Our Lady's hands. Some of them come all the way down, and some of them fall short. And the ones that fall short, those are the graces that people don't cooperate with, the actual graces. So actual grace, as I like to say, is intended to get us in, keep us in, and increase in us the state of sanctifying grace. So it gets a little bit more complicated from here, but there's operating and cooperating grace. And I would actually encourage everybody to read this. I put a lot of work into it. But aside from that, it's not just a favor to me. It's because it's actually worth pondering. Operating grace, in short, is God working in us without us. Okay, God working in us without our help.
Well, Brother Andre Marie, the St. Benedict Center, host of Reconquest radio program. A new episode debuts tonight and every Wednesday. Well, Brother, you sell yourself short sometimes when you say, well, you should read this. I'll put a lot of work into it. I read everything that you write. I even read the written stuff that you send me. Like, for example, your August 11th letter, I read it twice. It was so good. About the Lutheran guy that left the faith.
Ah.
I read it, and I'm going like, this is a really good story. I think brothers should tell this story, or maybe on an episode of Reconquest. Maybe you did, I just didn't know.
No, I did. I didn't talk about the Lutheran from New Jersey. I did write about him. but yeah. And by the way, if anybody wants to get me in print, or not just me, but us in print, you can sign up, go to Catholicism.org and sign up to get on our mailing list. That would be nice.
Yes, Mancipia is a wonderful publication. It comes out once a month. Don't forget the little envelope that comes with it and sticks some duckies in there and mail it back. They need it.
Thanks.
Now, brother, your friend, I know you know Canon Moreau, the ICK. Canon said something about, I just love listening to him talk with his little high-pitched French accent, Americanized French accent. He said, he was in France, okay? And he said he went on a pilgrimage and he did a pilgrimage on the island that Blessed Karl of Austria died on. And he said, I was on the plane ride back and I'm sitting in my seat and guess who they sit next to me? A Southern Baptist woman. And then she goes on to explain the things that she loves about the Catholics is that everywhere she goes in the world, she travels a lot. She's a world traveler for her business. Everywhere she travels in the world, there's always a Catholic church there. And, you know, and Catholics are always made to feel at home there. And then he doesn't say how the subject came up, but he talks about the sacrament of reconciliation. And he says, and then she tells me that, you know, through her Baptist faith, that she doesn't need me. That I'm not necessary to confess sins to. That, you know, once washed in the blood, always washed in the blood. And I found this really interesting, the way he explained it through this Sunday's gospel. That when he says, what does our Lord tell the 10 lepers after he heals them? What does he tell them to do?
Go show yourself to the priest.
Go show yourself to the priest. And he says, this is a reference to reconciliation. He said, go show. And then the one that comes back, you know, is the one, he says, thy faith has made thee whole. And then he says something else about it that I had never heard. And he goes, why do you think it is the Catholic tradition passed down from the apostles that when the sacrament of reconciliation is given, the priest sits in the chair, the penitent usually on his knees. Why? He says, well, the priest is acting as a judge. And mm-hmm. just the way he put it was beautiful. And I'm like, man, I'm not one of these people that fears priests and the sacrament and the confessional, but there are a lot of people that are. You know, it benefit tremendously from hearing Canon Moreau's, in a very brief, maybe 6-7 minutes, his homily on the subject on Sunday.
Yeah, I mean, and of course, this is a standard approach to this passage. And I think it's Saint Augustine, points out that, you know, in the old law, they could only show themselves to the priest because it actually was a commandment in the Mosaic law for lepers. If lepers were healed, in order to be admitted back to society, they had to show themselves to the priest. And our Lord adds, and offer the offering that was prescribed by Moses. Why? Because Moses said, if the priest proclaimed you to be healed, then you would make this certain offering at the temple or the tabernacle before the temple was built. And you were readmitted to society. The priest had that function. Now, the fathers of the church point out, and I think it's a sermon of St. Augustine on this point, says that in the old law, the priests could only declare you to be healed. In the new law, they have the power, by virtue of the priesthood of Jesus Christ, to do the healing when it comes to spiritual leprosy of sin.
Mm.
So the old law was less perfect. The old law had, the priest had less power, you know, because he didn't have the participation in the high priesthood of Jesus Christ. But in the new law, they have the power to truly forgive sins. And, you know, our Lord's critics were correct when they said, who can forgive sins but God only? Well, God can give powers to men to forgive sins. But of course, it is a divine power. But it's a divine power that's on loan, as it were, in the priest. So Jesus Christ being the high priest, even as man, he could say, your sins are forgiven. But that came from the divine power. And so too, the priesthood of Christ comes from the divine power to the individual priest.
So like Rush Limbaugh used to say, talent on loan from God.
And priest, you know, I had that in my head when I was saying that.
When you said that, that's what I was thinking. That Canon or Father Jean Bonner could say in the confessional, I have talent and power on loan from God.
Yeah.
Brother, we have 8 minutes left because I have to get you out on time. Finally today, so go to Catholicism.org and you could sign up for Manchipia, the newsletter, and you can also register for the St. Benedict Center Conference, which I'm going to and many of you are going to, and Brother will be there and all the brothers and sisters. It's a wonderful time of year in New Hampshire to be there. So go to Catholicism.org. You'll see the banner ad at the top of the homepage. Click on that. That will take you to the registration. You need to get registered as soon as possible. Make your plans to travel. I sent this to you, and I know it was late, and I know you're busy, but and as I said, on the digitization of man article here, this is something that you and I talk about, have talked about recently and frequently, And I don't know with your busy schedule if you're able to keep up with what your with what James Corbett has been sending out of late. Have you?
I'm embarrassed to say that my reading has been trimmed down to almost nothing. Essential things for things I write, because I can't write unless I read, but I have a new job.
I understand. We all understand. But one of the things that Corbett wrote about is James Corbett it is time to give up your social, delete your social media. This is on his Solutions Watch. And this is what Christopher Lippold, Crisis Magazine, on the digitization of man, he makes this point that, just one sentence. Now, at the beginning of the digitization of man, such major changes in society can come and pass within a year. You know, this is one of the things that I think detracts greatly from what we began this conversation about, and that's appreciation. Because you're always moving. There's an app for that, right? Well, if there's an app for that, well, then that kind of takes some of the adventure away in doing it yourself, right? So I think that these subjects are all kind of related to the three A's and then the grace needed to carry them out from your ad rim.
Yeah, I mean, one of the blessings that has come with me in the having to be headmaster is that it's actually torn me away from my computer quite a bit. And one of the things I had to do in the summer to kind of plan for this was a friend who does volunteer work for us. She was willing to do this. God bless her heart. But she does all my social media stuff now. I mean, not all of it, but most of it. You know, every day I would put out the saint of the day, you know.
Right.
And some relevant things like that I would throw out online on the social media, because frankly, it's kind of the new Areopagus. This is where people show up to hear some strange thing, right? And I didn't want to abandon it entirely because, well, I know from looking at the back end of the website that it does bring people to the website. So you got people reading these things that wouldn't read it unless it was there on social media. So this wonderful volunteer has been doing that. But as a result, I don't have to, right? So I'm not so frequently looking at these things, and it is good for one's peace of mind, not to be constantly addled by the gibberish of social media. There's something terribly superficial about it, and it really is anxiety provoking. So whereas real reading, you know, reading a good book, whether it's fiction or whether it's nonfiction, is actually not that way. It doesn't addle the brain, unless it's, you know, something stupid and evil. But good books don't addle the brain. They enlighten the soul.
Let me tell you what I did yesterday for not social media and contemplating the wonder of the nature of living in the country. You know what I did?
What's that?
I learned how to drain the water tanks on the RV. Now, the first thing that you have to get over is, oh, wait a minute, that's like a sewer tank, right? Am I really going to hook this thing up? I never thought once, wow, I should go get my iPad and I should post the drain of the black tank on my own, any social media that I have remaining. It's one of the things that you don't think about until you actually get out into the country, and you're not slaving away to your iPhone or shackled to your desk and your computer. That there's actually real peace in working. There's actually real peace in doing things with your hands. You know, people think that, oh, farm life is so hard. Well, maybe while the farmer is farming and sweating, he's actually contemplating something, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if you can do it right, you know, there's a film with Tom Cruise in it called The Last Samurai. And there's a scene in there where this American, played by Tom Cruise, is working with the Japanese, with the samurai people, the samurai's families, and he's helping them, you know, plant rice or something. Well, he's in a hurry and he's going through it, you know, as quickly as he can, and he plants the row all crooked and he gets finished his row before everybody else is finished. But then you see the Japanese and the way they do it. They're going about it in a very methodical way. It's kind of slow, but it's deliberate. Their rows are perfectly straight. The rice is perfectly spaced out. And every once in a while, when there's a breeze, they all stand up and sort of take in the breeze and enjoy it. And then they go right back down to working again. That's the difference between going about work in a sort of contemplative way and then, or going about work in this sort of manic, modern, distracted, fanatical way, which is unpeaceful, right? So the image you get in the cinematography was fantastic. The image you get is these people had a peaceful existence, even though they were fighters. They had a peaceful existence, whereas this American who had basically had ADHD from murdering Indian children and women in the Indian Wars. Not ADHD. PTSD.
PTSD.
He was messed up, and he was an alcoholic. But he learned by living in the society over time to have this more deliberate, you know, contemplative sort of peaceful existence. Now, I'm not praising the virtues of Bushido, you know, the code of the samurai, which is nothing like the code of chivalry. Nothing so good as the code of chivalry. But just in that one little thing, they approach their work in a way which is much more naturally virtuous and naturally good.
Well, and if you want to see something, you mentioned The Last Samurai. There are very few filmmakers today that can give you you can actually contemplate their work, or contemplation may come to their work. Terrence Malick is one of them. And if you watch The Hidden Life, the life of Blessed Franz Jägerstätter, you know, I forgot what time it was. I'm just staring at the Swiss Alps and the beauty of the cinematography. I forgot what movie I was watching, I think.
He's a master cinematographer.
And there's another one. There's a younger guy that's a master cinematographer too. His name's Christopher Nolan. And if you watch the movie Dunkirk, even though you're watching a war film, it doesn't feel like a war movie. It feels like I'm watching the beauty of the French, the beaches of France being beaten up by Nazis.
Yeah. I'm not a Christopher Nolan fan. I did kind of like that film, but the soundtrack was absolutely dyspeptic. I mean, it was this constantly, talk about addling. I mean, it had this tension that was constant throughout the film. But hey, that's just me, you know, de gustibus, as they say.
Now, brother, what is going on tonight's episode of Reconquest that we will hear?
Tonight's episode of Reconquest is a solo show. Actually, no, it's not. I'm sorry. I'm distracted. Tonight's episode is, my guess is Commander John Sharp, aforementioned.
Oh, good.
It's called Music and the Restoration of Christian Culture. So the name is inspired by Dr. John Sr., whose books John Sharp has brought back into print on the death of Christian culture and the restoration of Christian culture. So we're talking about the role of music in restoring Christian culture.
Yeah, and Doug Bursaw has also brought some of those books that John's brought back into print, like The Guild State. That's a book that was out of print that IHS Press got back into print, and Doug sells it, and we sell it to you. And it's one of the farming books at the Founders Trading Post at shop.mikechurch.com. All right, brother, go back to headmastering.
Yes, sir. Good to talk to you, Mike. God bless you, and God bless all our listeners.
All right. Thank you very much, Brother Andre.